You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by Food Matters Live.
Welcome to the Table Talk podcast. I'm Stephen Gates. I'm a writer and broadcaster specialising in food and science. In this episode, I'm asking this simple question. How do we make sustainable diets mainstream? We all know that we need to eat more sustainably for the good of our fellow humans and the planet, but at the moment, the people actually doing so are limited. Is sustainability just a fluffy, feel-good concept that we ditch as soon as we spot the words ribeye steak on a menu? And how do we shift this? Well, the perfect person to tackle these questions is Professor Sir Charles Godfrey. He's the director of the Oxford Martin School. He's a population biologist who specialises in the relationship between the global food system and sustainability. Welcome, Sir Charles.
Good morning.
Good morning. Can you explain the work that you're doing at the Oxford Martin Future Food Programme?
Yes, what the Future of Food Programme is, it's an initiative to bring together everyone in the university, in Oxford University, who has an interest in food. And I guess one of the ways we do this is by having models in which we can explore future diets and say what that does not only for the economy, but also for our health and for the environment. So we try to stitch together people with different expertise to address really complex and multidimensional issues, such as what happens as diets change into the future.
And so you're looking at the development of what we're likely to eat in the future as much as how we produce the food to supply that.
Yes, but both parts of that. And again, what we do with the models is we use it to sort of ask questions in the future. So we're going to be talking about sustainable food. So we can say, well, if we were to change our diets in one particular way, then what difference would that make, for example, to greenhouse gas emissions, and what difference would it make to our health? And the models are by no means perfect, but in a complex, non-linear type situation, doing these models is about the only way that one can explore these issues into the future.
And just before we dive into the detail of this, are you feeling optimistic? Are you excited about the possibilities?
I am optimistic. I'm optimistic because, well, you mentioned my intellectual background. So I'm a population biologist. And I guess the single most extraordinary thing that's happened in my adult intellectual life is we can see global populations beginning to decelerate. And actually, we know how that works. We know that if you bring people out of poverty, if you give them access to reproductive health care, if you educate their kids, especially their girls, then naturally population fecundity goes down and you get this sort of virtuous cycle. It sort of improves the economy. So I think we can intellectually look into the future and say there will be a time in which humanity's demands of the environment will begin to initially plateau and then go down. And even with the things that we didn't know about 20 or 30 years ago, such as climate change, I still am optimistic, although perhaps I should say guardedly optimistic, because it does mean that we have to make politically difficult and hard decisions pretty damn soon, to put it crudely.
Yeah. And are we still looking at a population of 11 billion? Do you think we'll peak at 11 billion?
It's hard to say. And I think any time now, the United Nations Bureau of Population will do an updated updated estimate. In one sense, it doesn't matter if it's sort of 9, 10 or 11 billion by mid-century, by end of the century. It's just a real clarion call that on many fronts, but we're talking about food today, on food in particular, we have to act. So yes, it's important. We should know what it is. And there is good news that the increase is decelerating. But whatever the precise figure is, it's very clear we have to act on food.
Yeah. And when we talk about sustainability, can you just unpack the main things we're looking at? So is it climate change? Is it soil deterioration? What are the lead subjects that you think we need to tackle?
It's quite hard to define what sustainability means. And I guess the way I think of it is how we can produce food in a way that doesn't undermine our capacity to produce food into the future, And in a way that protects the part of the natural world that we rely on, not only to produce food, but to produce other things as well. So the technical term is natural capital. So the parts of the world, the parts of the natural world that help purify our water, provide pollinators, reduce air pollution and things. So sustainability means producing food, but in a kinder way to the environment. And actually, so again, my background is population biology in biology, also to leave some space for nature.
Yeah. I would say that most people know that we need to change how we eat, but I don't think that that many people are doing so. What are the barriers to making sustainable diets mainstream?
I largely agree with you, and one has to be very careful because one looks at this through the prism of one's own experience. But the students that I teach, I think really over the last 10 years, I've seen a real noticeable change in what they know about food and how that they're changing their diets. Now, again, sort of students at my university are not a representative cross-section of the whole of the population, yeah. But I do see things changing there. So what do we need to do? Well, there's the easy bit, which government likes because it's fairly straightforward to do, and it sort of puts the agency onto us, the consumer, and that's to provide more information about what is and what is not sustainable. And we know, and pretty much in ballpark terms, at least, what are the best and what are the worst types of food. And there's certainly an argument that we need more research and we need to get better information about that. But that shouldn't be an argument for not starting with what we know at the moment. So at least in broad terms, we know what is a diet that's better for the planet, better for us. And a report that was published last year, the Lancet Commission on Planetary Health, that sort of pretty much does it for the environment. And full disclosure, the group in Oxford were responsible for some of the modelling underlying that. I guess one of the real challenges is to produce an environment, and here I mean a sort of social, political, economic environment that makes it easier for all actors to do the right thing. And by that, I mean us as individuals, I mean the food companies, the food sector, and other groups, for example, the people who procure food in the public sector. And I think that inevitably means that the state has to think about how it regulates and encourages and facilitates. And that means that the state has to intervene. But it is too easy to sort of throw up our hands and say, oh, well, we have craven politicians who don't do things. I think we as civil society have to create an atmosphere in which our politicians can make the right decisions, and they often know what they have to do. And I don't often quote Jean-Claude Juncker, but he said something, I don't know if it's original, that often we know what to do. What we don't know is how to get re-elected when we do the right thing.
Should we make the idea of eating well something that's attractive, simple, and part of everyone's daily life?
I would fully endorse that, but it's not enough. And, you know, people like us who are really interested in food, then we react to messages like that. But a lot of people... And especially people who are living tough lives, and they just don't have the cognitive bandwidth to make these really quite complex decisions. And not because they're not smart, it's just because they're coping with a really complex life and doing many other things. So I think that there is a lot that the private sector and the public sector working together can do to facilitate making people better decisions. To facilitate people making better decisions more simply.
Can you give me a practical example of what could be done?
Well, I think if you walk down some of the areas in our major cities, and especially the poorer parts of the cities, then you are assailed by very cheap, very unhealthy food. And we perhaps need to think about how this has happened and how we can make it easier for companies selling more nutritious, more sustainable food to compete in that marketplace.
Yeah. Before we go any further, actually, can you just define what you think a sustainable diet is? Are we talking veganism? Are we talking a small, limited amount of meat, but to continue eating meat? How would you best define it?
Well, that's very hard, and I wouldn't defend it in terms of particular food types, and I would make it very context specific. So, yes, I do think that we in the rich world, let's talk about the UK, do need to consume less meat than we do at the moment. But I would not say that to a pastoralist living in northern Kenya, where the only food that he or she can get hold of is animal based. Yeah. So it has to be done subtly and in a more and in a contextual way. There is an element about personal values in it. So becoming vegan or becoming vegetarian is one way of reducing meat. I myself am a flexitarian. I try and eat less meat. I find it very hard to give it up completely.
Yeah. So, what did you have for supper last night?
What did I have for supper last night? I had fish with broad bean pilau.
Oh, very good. Very good. Bit of fish there. Bit of protein.
There was a bit of fish there, yes.
Yeah. So it's a balance then, really.
That's right.
And trying to get the balance right. What are the barriers to making these sustainable diets mainstream? Do you think meat is just too cheap at the moment?
So, well, let me answer your general question first, and then specifically about the price of meat. I think that the barriers are... part of the barriers are education and information, but it is too easy to say it is just that. So I think some of the barriers is that sustainable diets are not yet mainstream in government. Now, within the UK, the DEFRA, our Food and Environment Ministry, has asked Henry Dimbleby to come up with a national food strategy. And I know from hearing Henry Dimbleby at the launch that he's going to be thinking very much about sustainable and healthy diets. Mm. So hopefully that will be a first step towards mainstreaming, making some of these issues mainstream. Then the issue around meat. Well, if you ask an economist, what do you do with unsustainable, food types that have a major effect on the environment, then economists will say, well, technically, the negative effects that these food types have, they are what are called externalities. And what you do is you bring some of the cost of that in, and that inevitably makes those foods more expensive. Now, in one sense, I find that really quite a compelling argument. What I worry about is that it's regressive, in the sense that someone like me, I'm a middle-class professor, I can afford it, but not everyone. Yeah. Can afford it. Now, there are counter arguments to that. So my colleague Susan Jem, who was on the radio over the weekend, and she's an expert on sugar taxes. So sugar taxes are designed to reduce consumption of sugary sodas, which is a pro an anti-obesity effect. And her response is that actually many of the effects are regressive. So yes, you do have a tax, but the people who benefit are particularly the people on low incomes. Now, one of the things I do think is exciting, and I'm not someone who believes in technological silver bullets, but there are all sorts of alternative protein ideas being explored at the moment. Now, at the moment, they're really quite expensive, but one could see in the future that there are alternative protein types that taste as good as meat. We're beginning to see it in some of the plant-based burgers.
Yeah.
And so perhaps in the future, we can have cheap alternative to some of the food types that we do want to make more expensive to reduce consumption.
Well, and could it go the other way around? I mean, could we subsidize those industries that create more sustainable food types or sustainable food kind of arenas within which you can have a better diet?
Yes. I am not sure that the argument that healthy foods are expensive is correct. So I think it is more creating demand for them. And actually, if one created more demand for the healthier food types, then they may be cheap already, but certainly increased demand through economies of scale would then reduce their price.
That's so right. If you want to eat healthily, you know, the vegetable, fresh vegetables are pretty cheap in the supermarkets. But maybe what needs to be subsidized is the knowledge and the understanding of what to do with those things and to make it, you know, there's so much marketing cash put into the world around the food itself. And maybe that's where help needs to be given.
So I think that's certainly true. I wouldn't rule out completely positive subsidies for healthy foods, but subsidies should be used, I think, almost as a last resort, just because they're easy to put on, difficult to take out. Yeah. Your second point about subsidies for more information. Now, an economist would say that that's exactly the right thing. You should put money in their jargon. It's a market failure. And again, full disclosure, I'm a trustee, but the Food Foundation has done a wonderful campaign called Peas Please, in which some hugely talented advertisers, marketing industry people, pro bono created some advertisements for vegetables, and you can find them on the web, but they're just a wonderful example of how you can make vegetables more appealing, especially for kids.
Yeah, so maybe we should be giving subsidies so that we can put those on television in the middle of Love Island, and that'll start changing people's diets a bit more.
Yes.
So what are the low-hanging fruit here? What are the simplest things people can do practically? If I go out to buy the ingredients for my food, what are the things I should be doing to help most?
Well, a very simple guide is to eat less meat, especially red meat, and to increase the amount of fruit and vegetables you have. The latter will particularly help your health, and the former will help the environment.
That's pretty simple stuff, isn't it? And is the concept of food miles an outdated and irrelevant concept now?
It's not irrelevant, but I think what we've learned over the last 10 or 15 years is it's not food miles per se. It's the whole imprint, the whole footprint of the food type. So you can have... Now, I may have this precisely wrong, but it's you could grow strawberries in Cornwall in heated polytunnels and have a greater greenhouse gas footprint than if you grew them in southern Spain, which is further away, but where you don't have to put the money into the heating.
Yeah.
I would also make the point that and this is where getting the information is difficult, that it is relatively easy to compare by greenhouse gas emissions. So the old joke, you can't compare apples and oranges. Well, you can when it comes to greenhouse gas emissions. And it gets harder when you then go into other dimensions. Perhaps water is the next easiest to do, but then you get into much more complicated things such as biodiversity.
Yeah.
And a number of people, we're at Oxford, are trying to make sense of some of that data, but it's still hard. But that's not an argument against trying to do it, and it's not an argument against using the best data we have at the moment to make decisions.
And do you think things like sort of diversity taxes or biodiversity taxes would be important? I mean, does it all come down to price when we're talking about farmers, producers, and retailers?
I think that tax fiscal measures is one of the spectrum of things that one should use. I think that regulation is also helpful, And then we've already talked about things like education. So I think one should be pretty Catholic in the range of measures that one uses, and that when one does do things, one should put in the monitoring in value and evaluation so that you learn as you go along.
And I think a lot of consumers might say that there's a conspiracy between governments and farmers, producers and retailers. You know, they're all in each other's pockets, and they're sort of fending off concepts of sustainability. Do you think that's right?
No. Now, obviously, there are many interest groups, from the producers, the whole of the food chain, including the supermarkets and NGOs as well. So, yeah, it's a complex issue. It's a complex sort of environment out there with people arguing. And yes, there is lobbying and such, but I would go back that often policymakers know what they want to do, but fear that there isn't a political constituency behind them. So the more we can talk about these issues and talk about them in an evidence-based way, the more, and podcasts such as yours is one of the means of increasing this conversation among civil society. I think that can be good. I think that going back to issues that we're interested in Oxford is we as academics, we have several roles. One of them is as advocates, where we're talking about our informed opinion. But I think there's another role that we can have is when we try and put aside our advocacy role and try and be sort of brokers of the evidence. So try and get at the evidence and try and put it out there in as transparent and the policy free way as we can, so that anyone can make an opinion about have an opinion about what to do based on that evidence.
Yeah. Do you have many people who are sort of deniers of the need for sustainability in the same way that you have climate change deniers?
No, and or at least I don't come across people like that, with the exception of a minority who sort of viscerally oppose anything to do with climate change. I think the real issue is that it when it affects you personally. I think if we've learnt anything from the political traumas of the last 3 or 4 years and the rise of populist political movements, it's that simplistic economic arguments that things benefit everyone do not necessarily have political traction. Yeah. And the groups that lose out from things are motivated to act much, much more than the groups who benefit. And it's often because the losses are concentrated and the benefits are diffuse.
And so, can you give us an example of that?
Yes. So if we talk about, so I've just said that we need to eat less red meat for both environmental, especially for environmental reasons, and although the effect is not as strong, also for health reasons as well. Now, I think that message would seem to be extremely unpalatable to someone who whose income depends on their beef herd and things. Mm. So I think we have to look very carefully about how people like that can maintain a living and things. I think that some of the issues around eating less and better, and especially some of the fabulous beef producers we have in this country, then really going for the quality end is important there. And then I think that some of the arguments or some of the discussions we've been having about what might replace the common agricultural policy once we come out of the EU, if we come out of the EU, are really interesting. So the document that DEFRA produced, Health and Harmony, is really quite revolutionary. It's talking about how we can support our rural communities when the money going into rural communities, and it probably has to go into rural communities in the high-wage economy, is purpose much more for simultaneously supporting those communities and producing public goods. So I think there's a really interesting discussion to have there. And I already see that some of the more go-ahead parts of the livestock industry are thinking exactly what their industry will look like in 10 or 20 years time, when many of these issues of sustainability are much, much more mainstream than they are today.
And what sort of, can you give us an example of the sorts of things that we're looking at? Are we talking to turning fields into playgrounds or something a bit more complex than that?
Well, a little bit more complex than that. But when you're saying playgrounds, then actually some of the landscapes in which livestock are produced are the if we don't treat them as playgrounds, we want to walk and we want to spend our recreational time in them. So, again, in the economist jargon, that is a public good. And someone can argue that some public money goes into that. But there are things like carbon sequestration, habitats for biodiversity, reducing flood loss, and many other things that land at the moment, which might be seen purely as producing livestock, could produce multiple outputs, some of which are private goods, the meat the farmer sells, and some of which are public goods. And there is a straight economic argument that if you're producing public goods, then one should get money from the public purse.
So it's exciting possibilities as well. Like, I understand that your optimism in this area, because that could be fantastic for the country as well.
It could do. And it will be very complex. And the DEFRA document actually is very sensible in talking about having a gentle transition, because there will be winners and losers along the way, and it needs to be done at a sensible speed. But yes, it is exciting, and it could lead to a countryside that is both better for the people who live and make their livings in it, as well as a more sustainable countryside in on a number of different dimensions.
It seems like a commodity that's too valuable to leave it in to politicians to cock up, doesn't it? It sounds like one of those things that could be wonderful and could be just ruined by people who need to be elected next year.
Well, there are complexities on that, but it is too easy a hit just to blame everything on politicians.
Yeah.
And we have to be there sort of nudging them in the right direction. I'm not saying there aren't some venal politicians, but there are also politicians who really want to do the right thing.
Yeah. Now, a lot of the people listening to our podcast are food industry professionals, and they will be thinking, apart from all the wonderful things they can do, how can I incorporate this into, you know, still making a profit and being able to make food and sell it to people? What are the things that food producers can do, do you think? Is it back to this idea of making sustainability sexy or personal, or is it about cost?
So that's a really interesting question. So why, what's in it for industry in order to do things better? I think that there is some reason why they should do things better, and that is companies that do things well are attractive for consumers. And so if you look at a company such as Unilever, which is really, especially under the CEO who's just left, Paul Pullman, who's really stressed sustainability, I think they have rightfully got a lot of credit out there. Talking to people in the private sector, it's very interesting that some of the reasons why they want to do better is that they want to attract the very best staff, and their very best staff want to work for a company that they can be proud of. So I think that there are all sorts of things going on within the private sector, which if you do it right, you'll have better staff and you'll make more money. Now, having said that, I don't think that's enough. And I think that we need to have a conversation about what a modern values-driven food company would look like. And I think there's some hard questions then for government about whether we have the structure of our corporate law and the fiduciary burdens we put on boards, have we got that right to make
sense? Ooh, they're bringing out the big guns now.
Well, it's complex, but the obsession with shareholder value and the tyranny of the quarterly report is that actually fit for purpose in a in an environment where we do have to think in longer terms? And actually, it was brought in based on economic theory that said, well, this is the right way to maximize the benefits for everyone. I think the economics profession has moved on, and there is good theory within economics saying that's perhaps not the best way to organize our corporate governance. And it's a big question. It's a complex question. But to me, that's, and it's a nerdy question as well, to put it bluntly.
But it's fundamental economics there. Is that possible to change corporate culture? Well, corporate regulation?
Well, let me go back to some of my colleagues in Oxford at the moment, who I think are writing in a very interesting ideas about this. It's not only people here, but elsewhere. So a colleague of mine in the business school, Colin Meyer, has a really interesting book out called Prosperity, which sort of talks about this in great detail. Paul Collier at the Blavatnik School of Government, and he has a book out at the moment called The Future of Capitalism, which talks about this and many other things as well. It's an intensely personal book as well. So, and you can point to other economists, Danny Roderick, for example, who writing about this as well. There's a ferment of interesting ideas out there in the sort of academic and policy world, and these need to be brought much more into government. And there are some interesting ideas out there.
Yeah, that actually sounds exciting. I have to admit, I thought that this would be a conversation where you would be throwing your hands up in the air a little bit and saying that you're pessimistic about so many elements of this. So I'm very excited about your optimism and about this, the concept of fundamental change to corporate culture. I think that could be important as well, because we need corporations, and we need companies producing food for us, and we need them to succeed as well, but to do it in a way that's not going to impact negatively on the planet. Well, that was fantastic. Thank you very much for talking to us, Professor Sir Charles Godfrey, from Director of Oxford Martin School. And I hope that we can talk again, perhaps in a year's time, and that some of these things that you've suggested have been put into effect.
Thanks very much indeed.
Thank you for listening to the Table Talk podcast. If you've enjoyed it, please share a review. If you like what you've heard, find out more on foodmatterslive.com or find us on Twitter and Facebook.